The title of this lesson is What the Scriptures Reveal About Reincarnation. But it's going to take us just a few moments to get to that part of the subject because I've got two or three other things to talk about before we get to the meat of the evening. In these lessons, especially if you're new to this way of thinking and to unity, you're going to hear some things that your intellect will absolutely refuse to believe. And that's all right. It's all right. It's very important, however, that each one of us here keep an open mind. Keep your mind open, not to what I say, but to what that spirit within you is saying to you. Because your teacher, your spiritual teacher, is speaking to you. You see, you are upon this earth to discover what you are all about. The secret is within you. If you can discover how you work inside yourself, if you can unlock the secrets of this marvelous mind, this infinite mind that you are an individualized expression of, you will find that life will be a joy. Life is for living and for understanding and for loving and for knowing, and you have an infinite capacity to experience life at its highest. But this can only occur as you and I become unlocked, as we are separated from the limitations that are self-imposed within our own thought and within our emotional nature. So do not try now or at any time to listen with the mind that already has its mind made up and hears these precepts, these concepts, trying to fit them into what it already believes. What you believe is not enough. And the truth will not fit itself into the limited concepts of our intellectual thinking. Last week, you remember that we spent almost all of lesson two establishing the premise that there is no death, that man is spirit, and spirit has or is eternal life, that spirit cannot die. And you are spirit. Spirit is its own thing, and its identifying word is I am. Spirit has its own eternal identity, which cannot be lost. However, this identity of spirit must be consciously established by each individual expression of spirit. It cannot be imposed from without. And you and I, as individualized expressions of spirit or of God, are becoming consciously aware of ourselves within ourselves. And this process of the development of awareness or consciousness is what is back of what we call reincarnation. Most of you here have heard of the Reverend Leslie D. Weatherhead, theologian and author. Perhaps you've read some of his books. In a lecture entitled The Case for Reincarnation that was delivered in 1957, I read to you. The intelligent Christian asks not only that life should be just, but that it shall make sense. Does the idea of reincarnation help here? I think it does. Let us suppose that a very depraved or entirely materialistic person dies. Let us suppose that from a religious point of view, that person has entirely misused his earth life. Will his translation to a spiritual plane do all that needs doing? Will it not be like putting a person who has never given himself any chance to understand music into an everlasting concert? Can a man who has entirely neglected spiritual things be happy in a spiritual environment? If you say, oh, well, he can learn in the next phase, can he really? Doesn't such a speculation make the earth life meaningless? I don't think that we shall be able to skip the examinations of life like that. It would be incongruous and unsound as telling a medical student who failed his qualifying examination, well, just don't bother, but go on treating people as if you would qualify. If I fail to pass those examinations in life which can only be taken while I dwell in the physical body, shall I not have to come back and take them again? If every birth in the world is the birth of a new soul, I don't see how progress can ever be consummated. Each has to begin at scratch. There can never be a perfect world unless gradually those born into it can take advantage of lessons learned in earlier lives instead of starting at scratch. Well, I suppose that you and I are here this evening because we are tired of starting at scratch. And we're ready to get on with our spiritual lessons, and that's when the system of reincarnation not only makes sense, but you begin to understand that you can only develop so far without a working understanding of this aspect of the master plan. It's a part of the master plan that the universe has created for our growth. Now, reincarnation is not an advanced school. All of us who are still working with reincarnation are in the kindergarten of the spiritual world. We're not working on our master's degree at that point. Now, in order to discover itself, spirit must experience itself. This is why that we're given these earthly experience adventures that we call lives. 1 John, see what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. And purifying himself in the scriptures, we have always thought of as becoming good. Did you not think that I will become a good Christian? He was not talking about that kind of purity. He was not talking about becoming good. He was talking about becoming real. Think of that. He was talking about becoming a real person and understanding the process of stopping being what we are not and beginning to become what we already are. And what are we? In Romans, he said, children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. And reincarnation is the system that permits involvement and interaction with life, wherein that we learn what we really are and establish for all time our own individual spiritual identity, our own Christ consciousness. And reincarnation leads to that point wherein that the child of God in us is resurrected into its own true identity. You recall last week that I did not have time to respond to one of your questions. What happens if there is an aborted birth? The word abort comes from the Latin abortare, meaning to die, to disappear, or to miscarry. Well, we just finished a lesson that said that you cannot die. You can't die. Now, examining abortare a little more deeply, we discovered that it comes from two Latin words, meaning off or badly, and another word that means arise or be born. So, abort really means to be born badly. It does not mean to die as much as it means to be born badly. Now, we have thought in the past when someone was born badly that they died. Now, we've discovered, at least I have, that you cannot die. So, if you're born badly, what happens? An aborted birth, wherein that the soul is so badly born that it didn't get born, guess what it would do? It just tries again. It waits a little while and tries again and makes it the next time. What would you do if you were prepared to take a trip that was very important to you and for one reason or another you missed your plane? You'd wait and catch the next one, wouldn't you? That would be the natural, normal thing to do. And there would hardly be a tragedy involved there or a lapse of your trip. And knowing you as I do, you wouldn't even pucker up about it or blame the the traffic situation. You would know that somehow that was working together for your good, because you know that in all things work together for the good of them that are loved of God. Now, in case of abortion, the soul has not actually incarnated and taken a human identity. That has not happened yet. It really has not been born. It was born badly. So, it is prepared for a new journey back into the world. And it merely waits for a moment upon the wind and very quickly selects another situation to come into. You see, you cannot kill a soul, for soul is spirit, and you cannot destroy or diminish its chance for growth. You cannot do that. You cannot kill anyone, and in the Ten Commandments, when we read, "Thou shalt not kill," it means you cannot kill. You may think you can, and you may try. But in the process, you will only diminish your own life. You will bring karma upon yourself, karma which means come back. That's really what it means, come back. We'll get into that in Lesson 4 next week. There are almost 400 people here this evening. And I'm absolutely certain that in this group there is someone who has suffered greatly because they thought that they had destroyed a being's life by causing an abortion. And if the only thing that comes out of this series of lessons is that you set yourself free from that great pain and suffering and shame and remorse, it will be more than worth it. You cannot kill, and you did not. That child was only born badly and only waited a moment upon the wind and found a more certain experience for itself. I know that you're aware that there are many natural abortions that women know that they have, but did you not know, most doctors will tell you, that there are far more aborted births that women have that they were not even aware that occurred. You see, if this happens in nature, then it must not be the tragedy that we have believed it to be. Now, do not hear me in this statement making either a pro or a con statement about abortion. We're talking about what happens to a soul that almost came into this experience of life but did not quite make it because of abortion. It merely waits because it is fully prepared for this great unfolding and new adventure that we call life. That spirit taking upon itself another body, and if it does not get that body form, it matters not. Another one is yet to come. Now to address ourselves to the subject of Lesson 3. What does our Judeo-Christian heritage tell us about the soul reentering the world in a body? And this evening I'll be quoting rather liberally from Reincarnation, an East-West anthology compiled and edited by Head and Cranston and published by Quest. In the 90th Psalm, we hear a prayer or an affirmation by Moses addressing the Lord concerning the death of human beings. "Lord, Thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Thou turnest man back to dust, and then sayest to him, Return, ye children of men. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night." Jeremiah. "Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee. And I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." Did you think that a little newborn baby was a brand new thing just getting started there? Oh, no. Ecclesiastes. "The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, See, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is now no remembrance of former things. In his Antiquity of the Jews, the Jewish historian Josephus states that there were three sects of philosophy among the Jews: the Essenes, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees. And the doctrine of the Sadducees was that souls die with the bodies. But both the Essenes and the Pharisees, he affirms, believed in rebirth. As to the Essenes, who have now become famous owing to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Josephus wrote, "They contemn the miseries of life. They show contempt for the miseries of life and are above pain. By the generosity of their minds, they rise above the normal experiences of life. And as for death, our war with the Romans gave abundant evidence what great souls they had in their trials. They smiled in their very pains and laughed to scorn those who inflicted torments upon them and resigned up their souls with great alacrity as expecting to receive them again. For their doctrine is this, that bodies are corruptible and that the matter they are made of is not permanent, but that the souls are immortal and continue forever, and that they come out of the most subtle air or ethers and are united to their bodies as to prisons." Good expression. "Into which they are drawn by a certain natural enticement, but that when they are set free from the bonds of flesh, they then, as released from a long bondage, rejoice and mount upward. These are the divine doctrines of the Essenes about the soul, which lay an unavoidable bait for such as have had once a taste of their philosophy." In other words, once you hear what they have to say about eternal life and the reentrance of the soul into the body form, you can hardly fail to believe it. The Pharisees, he wrote in the Antiquity of the Jews, believe that souls have an immortal vigor in them, and the virtuous shall have power to revive and live again, on account of which doctrines they are able greatly to persuade the body of the people. And Josephus himself, as you know, was a great Jewish historian. He was a priest, an intellectual, he was a mystic. He was a soldier. And he fought for his people, and he spoke for his people, and then in time became a Roman citizen. He was accepted by the Romans, an almost unique thing in that time. And he traveled far and wide and wrote greatly of what he saw, and much of what we know of that whole era comes from the writings of Josephus. And he was addressing some Jewish soldiers who desired to kill themselves rather than be captured by the Romans. This is what he said in the Jewish War Book. "The bodies of all men are indeed mortal and are created out of corruptible matter. But the soul is ever immortal and is a portion of the divinity that inhabits our bodies. Do ye not remember that all pure spirits, when they depart out of this life, obtain a most holy place in heaven, from whence, in the revolutions of ages, they are again sent into pure bodies?" In an early writing, Charles Fillmore, the co-founder of Unity, wrote, "The one who lives in the intellect has no consciousness of any other life except this, the one pertaining to his day and age and the small things of that sphere." The Hebrew prophets of old taught re-embodiment, but the people, being on a low intellectual plane, received the teaching as applying to certain spiritual leaders only. That has not changed in thousands of years. Even in our own great religions, there has been a tendency to take these larger truths that were taught for all men and to see them, though, only as the experience of unique persons selected by God, while the rest of us, who supposedly were second-class citizens of the universe, stood and watched in amazement and in awed reverence as these great ones who had abilities denied us performed. But you have not believed that, have you? In this universe, there are no second-class citizens, and especially not you. And anything that has ever been achieved by one spiritual being is the possibility of all others and must ultimately become our own demonstration. Fillmore continues, "When Jesus began to do his mighty works, they had various theories as to who he was." You see, they understood that a person who could perform things at that level was what you and I would call an advanced soul, a master. This was one who had accomplished greatly before in some other life. You see, they knew that a little baby would not just be born and then in some 31 years be able to master fully the ability to perform the intricate, miraculous things that Jesus Christ did. They understood the system. They maybe didn't believe it for themselves, but they understood the system. And so when he began to do these mighty things, they said, well, who is he? And from Luke, the 9th chapter, the 8th verse, of some that Elias had appeared, and of others that one of the old prophets was risen again. And they speculated on just which one of the old prophets that he was come back, because they knew that he was a mighty master. The re-embodiment of Elijah was promised. Elijah, one of the prophets of old. And in the last verse of the Old Testament, Malachi, the 4th chapter, the 5th verse, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And did you know that before the birth of John the Baptist, an angel, an emissary from God, appeared to his parents and told them that the son that they would have would be in the spirit and power of Elias? In other words, that John the Baptist would be the reincarnation of Elias or Elijah. And John's father, who was a rabbi, did not understand it and did not believe it. As a matter of fact, John's conception in the body of his mother Elizabeth was a miraculous conception, something of the nature of that conception that took place in Mary, the mother of Jesus. A great similarity between these cousins, John and Jesus, that was to come later. To show that the intellectual consciousness does not apprehend the previous experiences of its ego, when the priest later asked John, art thou Elias? He said, I am not. Only because he did not remember his other experiences. And to more fully portray its confusion and lack of understanding of its true location and being, John further answered, I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness. And so the intellect by itself is always a voice crying in the wilderness, and it will never get its bearings unless it consciously recognizes its higher wisdom or the Christ consciousness. Unquote. Charles Fillmore. Our higher consciousness is that Christ of us, our Christ awareness, our cosmic consciousness. This consciousness knows who it is, but that is wearing the mask of John the Baptist. And when question says, if you will receive it, this is Elias, which was for to come. In more fully explaining the ignorance of the people in this matter, Jesus further said in Matthew, the 9th chapter, but I say unto you that Elias is come already, and they knew him not. And then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. What is that but reincarnation? What is that but the master teacher, Jesus Christ, whom Christianity emulates and follows, talking about this system and giving an example of it and on other occasions indicating that this was not an unnatural experience at all. Now, there were some early church fathers also who spoke on reincarnation whose works have not been lost. There was a period in the church when everything that could be interpreted as a reference to reincarnation was confiscated and conveniently lost. Justin Martyr, who lived AD 100 to 165, expressly speaks of the soul inhabiting more than once the human body and denies that on taking a second time the embodiment form that it can remember previous experiences. Origen, an early church father. And this he said, the soul has neither beginning nor end. Every soul comes into this world strengthened by the victories or weakened by the defeats of its previous life. Its place in this world as a vessel appointed to honor or dishonor is determined by its previous merits or demerits. Its work in this world determines its place in the world which is to follow this. In other words, our experience here is determined by what we experienced in past lives and the quality of the work that we do within our own minds here and now will determine our place in the world which is to follow this experience. The hope of freedom is entertained by the whole of creation when the sons of God, who shall be gathered into one, when they shall have fulfilled their duties in this world. Now, the Encyclopedia Britannica states that Origen was, quote, the most prominent of all the church fathers, with the possible exception of Augustine, while St. Jerome at one time considered him as the greatest teacher of the church after the apostles. And St. Gregory of Nyssa called him the prince of Christian learning in the 3rd century. And I dare say that most of us have never heard of Origen. I've heard him quoted. And he further said, "Is it not more in conformity with reason that every soul, for certain mysterious reasons, is introduced into a body and introduced according to its deserts and former actions? Is it not rational that souls should be introduced into bodies in accordance with their merits and previous deeds, and that those who have used their bodies in doing the utmost possible good should have a right to bodies, both physical and mental, endowed with qualities superior to the bodies of others? The soul, which is immaterial and invisible in its nature, exists in no material place without having a body suited to the nature of that place. Accordingly, it at one time puts off one body, which was necessary before, but which is no longer adequate in its changed state, and it exchanges it for a second." This man lived in the 3rd century and had a tremendous impact upon the movement called Christianity, the most profound impact of any person in his time. And then something happened. In the year A.D. 553, an important church council anathematized or cursed the doctrine of the preexistence of the soul, and by implication, reincarnation is related to man's past. You see, in the early centuries of Christian history, there were many political battles that were raged over issues of doctrine, of church councils being convened to settle these disputes. And in the 6th century, the Byzantine emperor Justinian declared war against the Origenists, the followers of the learned church father Origen that I just told you about. And his high standing was virtually demolished, and his teachings were condemned. From that time, the flavor of the message of Christianity was significantly changed. And it was following that time that many or most of the doctrines of Christianity and the theology of Christianity began to be formed. You can accept for yourself the possible significance if that experience had not taken place in that year, and if a major voice, and it was not just Origen himself, but there were many, many other voices that were speaking with understanding. These people were mystics, and their whole teaching was cast aside and virtually eliminated. Question. If Christ was an advanced soul, was he only perfect according to the highest plane of this consciousness, or was he actually all the way there and at the point of total consciousness through all the dimensions? If so, was he the first to do this? In other words, was he just fully developed in the 3rd dimension, or was he a 4th dimensional or fully developed Christ-conscious person when he was born into this life? It seems fairly apparent that Jesus was the bridging over of the two, that he came into this life, his birth or incarnation as the Christ or the resurrected one was an expected and long-awaited event. But it's also quite obvious that Jesus had some mental and spiritual work to do in that incarnation. He wasn't just standing around doing nothing. You'll recall at an early age that he attracted attention because of his advanced knowledge. Remember when Joseph and Mary left Jerusalem in a caravan and discovered 2 or 3 days out on the trail that he was not there, and they had to backtrack, and they found him in a temple after 3 days sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and at his answers. And his mother was astonished and said, and her response was, "Son, why have you treated us so badly?" Have you ever heard that in your own life? Right in the middle of your highest, the people that are supposed to know you the best say, "Why have you done this to me?" Did you know that Mary, the mother of Jesus, never ever knew him for what he was? Read it. It's there in the scriptures. Another time, Jesus was teaching a group of his followers in a building, and Mary and his siblings, Jesus' siblings, appeared outside, and they sent a message inside who came to Jesus and said, "Your mother and your brother and your sisters are outside." And he said, "Who are my mother and my brothers and sisters?" "These people here." And he did not get up and go until later, after his teaching was over, he went outside. Now, outside means not only were they outside the building, but they were outside of his thinking, outside of his consciousness. They were never inside. They were never up tight, up close. They were never a part of the movement, of the demonstrations that were being made. Remember that he said, "If any man would come after me, follow me, emulate me. Let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." We discussed this in the first lesson of this series. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his countenance was altered, and his raiment became dazzling white, and behold, two men talked with him, Moses and Elijah. And this, of course, is the story of the transfiguration that is in 3 of the 4 Gospels in great detail, paralleling and agreeing in total content with this one magnificent story. And behold, two men talked with him. They just appeared there and were talking with him. Now, this was not a vision in the mind. Who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure. You see, the experience that Jesus was having, these beings were also having too. This glorious, dazzling experience. Now, Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, meaning they were in their human consciousness. And when we're walking around in our three-dimensional human condition, we're half asleep. Did you know that? That is what sleep means. And listen to what happened. "And they awakened when they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him." They awakened. Now suppose that at this moment while I'm talking to you, Moses and Elias appear right here, one on either side. Will you wake up? I'll flat guarantee you, if they suddenly appeared and they were not there a moment ago and they are there now and you see them, the hair on the back of your neck is just going to rise, isn't it? And you're going to know that something is going on. This has happened many, 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 many times. Many times. Jesus did this. He brought Lazarus back, and he brought others who were dead or who were killed back to life. He had the power. He had overcome death. And he himself, before his crucifixion, said, "The only power that you have to do this is the power that I give you. You can only do it because I let you do it. But even though I'm going to let you do it, you can't do it. So on Good Friday, don't get all worked up about what happened because these three beings were talking about what he was going to accomplish at Jerusalem. And it says, accomplish. He was to accomplish something. Fantastic. And he said on Sunday morning, watch what happens. Okay. And as the men were departing from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is well that we are here. You bet. If you saw it happen, you would say that too. Gosh, I'm glad I was there. I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't been there. Suppose it happened tonight and you went home and told the people that you know. They'd say, come on now, who are you trying to kid? You're kind of weird, aren't you? The supernatural is the most natural, except to the intellectual mind that can only think in terms of its limitations. And they said, let's build here three booths or tabernacles. Let's mark this spot. That's what that meant. They were nomads living in a wilderness, and when a great event happened, they always marked the spot by piling up a heap of stones so that when they came back later, they would say, that's where it happened, right there. And they would tell everybody who was not there this marvelous thing that occurred right there on that spot, and I was standing right here, and I put that stone right there on the top. That was a tabernacle. They said, let's make here three booths or tabernacles, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elias, meaning I have seen three fantastic people of equal dimension. So was Jesus the first? No. And yet his was the most important demonstration. What he accomplished in Jerusalem was the greatest accomplishment for mankind, or could be. It has not been yet, because mankind has not yet accepted this great truth about our spiritual and eternal nature. And even coming down the mountain, he told them, he said, don't you tell what has happened until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And they asked him, why did the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And he said, Elijah has already come, and they did not know him. And then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. Elijah had come back as John the Baptist, and some months before this had had his head cut off by Herod, and then had reappeared at this time with Moses in this great event. There's much more that the scriptures say. But the truth is that you and I could read and read and read, and we would not hear or see except that which our minds are prepared to see. Paul Tillich, theologian and philosopher, considered by many to be the foremost Protestant theologian of our time, said in one of his lectures, Symbols of Eternal Life, the nirvana symbol for eternal life points to the life of absolute fullness, not to the death of absolute nothingness, as sometimes is assumed. The life of nirvana is beyond distinction of subject and object. It is everything because it is nothing definite. But in order to reach this, many reincarnations are necessary. Proverbs, the 8th chapter, the 22nd through the 36th verse. The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up at the very first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills I was brought forth. Before he made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundation of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always. Rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the sons of men. And so it is. You are God's daily delight. And you have been long since, long before you can remember it. But you shall not forget it. because you are of his Spirit. So it is.